And now, a nod to this day. Oh, we could go on. So many great versions of the song, and everyone knows it. We think we know the man who wrote it, right? Every school child is taught that Francis Scott Key wrote the Star Spangled Banner as he watched the British bomb Fort McHenry during the Battle of Baltimore in the War of 1812. But did you know that he was out on the water with the British because President Madison gave him permission to sail out to try to rescue a friend who'd been kidnapped by the Brits? That while he speaks of the land of the free, he was a slave owner. But as a lawyer, he defended a slave's right to freedom, and he was part of a movement to return free blacks to Africa. And that after writing the song, Francis Scott Key never really seemed to pay much attention to it. In fact, Mark Leibson's new book, What So Proudly We Hailed Francis Scott Key A Life, mentions the song early on and then rarely again in telling the story of Key's life. We want to hear more from Mark Leibson. He joins us from WETA in Arlington, Virginia. Mark, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And happy 4th of July when we're hearing the song a lot. But just quickly, we want to go, as you do, over the story of Key's life. But have I got that right, that he, once he wrote it, didn't seem to really pay attention to it?
That's right. In public, he only spoke about it once for the rest of his life, and that was 20 years later in a political speech. And he really didn't talk very much about what he did. He sort of praised the defenders of Baltimore. And in his private correspondence, I was only able to find one letter, nor has anyone else who's ever studied Key's life, in which he talked about what happened that night. And in fact, the letter that he wrote to a close friend, he doesn't mention writing the song. He talked about the prisoner exchange, and he talked about the British officers whom he did not like.
It's just so interesting that in the course of all that we hear about him, and we'll get to that, you know, nobody's in any writing that you found slapping him on the back and saying, hey, great job with that song that people are singing. So that's so odd. If it were today, of course, he'd be on every talk show talking about it. So let's go back. He was born in 1779. Place him in this very young country right before the War of 1812. Who was he at that point?
Right. He was born during the American Revolution, so the country hadn't even started yet. He came from a well-off family, a Maryland family. They lived north of Frederick, Maryland, near the Pennsylvania border. A family of lawyers, and Frank, by the way, they called him Frank. Everybody did, family and friends. Frank went to St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland, which is still there, and had a classical education. He read the law after that, and he became a lawyer. And he moved with his wife to Frederick, Maryland, his hometown, in 1802. And then in 1805, he moved to Washington, D.C., and started a big law practice there. And he was 35 years old in 1814, and a very influential lawyer in Washington. And he was asked to go up to Baltimore following the Battle of Bladensburg. That's when the British burned Washington, D.C., and then they moved on up to Baltimore, and they had taken prisoner a man named William Beans, who was a surgeon. He was a friend of the Key family, and Key, with his reputation for being a convincing lawyer, was asked to go up to Baltimore and help arrange the release of Dr. Beans. Prisoner exchanges were common during the War of 1812.
This was, I mean, when you read some of the exchanges, you realize it was as bloody and awful as it was. It was also more civilized in many ways. People actually met and talked about things like exchanges. But the War of 1812, let's remind people, for those who forget their fourth grade history class, why was this conflict even happening? There'd already been the Revolutionary War.
Right. Well, there were several reasons, and one was Americans were angry that the British Navy was taking our sailors and kidnapping them, and it was called impressment of seamen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was sort of the reason that many were in favor of getting back at the British. But, you know, we were coveting Canada, mm-hmm. and that was one of the goals of the War of 1812, was to expand the United States into Canada. In fact, we tried to invade Canada when the war started. So we declared war on the British.
Right. And so the British are now, as you say, moving up the coast, although people like Francis Scott Key and his friends were not eager to go to war. But then this event, this prisoner exchange that he becomes involved in, Just tell us a little bit about who he is, because for the rest of his life, he does seem to be the person that people call in to try to settle things, whether in a courtroom or out in, you know, in the bay during a battle. Why? What was there about him?
Well, he was great in the courtroom. He people remarked about how persuasive he was, what a great speaker he was, and he influenced juries. So he argued over 100 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, not to mention scores or hundreds of other cases in the other courts. He later became U.S. attorney for Washington for 8 years. So he was a well-respected and influential lawyer in the nation's capital.
Well, and the first 4 words of your book kind of sum it up. The man could talk.
The man could talk, right.
I mean, whether in the courtroom or settling differences between people. And this brings us to this mission. He's on a ship sent out to try to wrangle this prisoner exchange and finds himself instead with a front row seat to this battle. It's so interesting to read this now, thinking of how we go to battle now. It seems rare that an enemy combatant would be on a ship in the middle of the ocean and somebody wouldn't sink it, you know. But he was there watching as the British attacked his homeland, Baltimore. What did he see?
The ship was in the Baltimore Harbor during the Battle of Baltimore. It was 25 straight hours of bombardment by this British armada. There was also a huge thunderstorm that night, a huge one. So when the rockets' red glare and the bombs were bursting in air, it happened during this crazy thunderstorm. And then about 3 o'clock in the morning, the guns went silent. But they did not know what happened, right? They didn't have the internet or Twitter back then, so nobody could tell them what happened. So they had to wait until the dawn's early light. And even then, when the dawn came up, it was cloudy. The rainstorm was still, you know, going on. Finally, they could see a flag on Fort McHenry, but it was limp. It was just hanging there. And then a breeze stirred, and he could see that it was the American flag. He realized the Americans had prevailed. It was quite an amazing sight, and this amateur poet was moved to write what he did that night.
Earlier this week, President Obama went to a bridge that spans the Potomac and connects Washington to Virginia. He was there to highlight the need for spending on infrastructure.
I would note that this bridge is named for the man who wrote the Star-Spangled Banner, Francis Scott Key.
Francis Scott Key. He wrote the Star-Spangled Banner 200 years ago after watching the Battle of Baltimore during the War of 1812. He scribbled the words on the back of a letter he had in his pocket when he realized the American flag was still there, flying over Fort McHenry. What happened next remains a bit of a mystery, but a relative or friend took the song to a printer. Soon it was displayed on broadsheets or posters all over town. The words were eventually set to a popular tune called To Anacreon in Heaven, and the rest, as they say, is history. It became our national anthem. We're learning all of this from Mark Leibson's new book, What So Proudly We Hailed, Francis Scott Key, A Life. He's with us. And Mark, let's just set aside the song for a minute, because that's just a small part of Francis Scott Key's story. He's a prominent lawyer, a friend to presidents, especially Andrew Jackson. He becomes very involved, as you would as a prominent person in the South in that day, in slavery. He owns slaves, but as a lawyer, he defends them in court. He also was a prominent figure in something called the American Colonization Society. This was a society devoted to sending free blacks back to Africa. Very controversial, because at first blush it felt like a liberation movement, but others thought it wasn't. Explain.
He was strongly against slave trafficking. You know, slavery was legal in the United States, but slave trafficking had been made illegal in 1808. But it was still going on. And Key and others who started the Colonization Society believed that one of the things that would come out of that would be the end to slave trafficking. They also believed that it would, quote unquote, civilize Africa. You know, and it was controversial. The abolitionists hated the idea of colonization.
Well, let's just take a second. Explain why. They felt it was like a false front, that it was actually a group that just didn't want blacks living among whites in America.
That's correct. That was the main abolitionist complaint about the Colonization Society, that it was a movement to rid the nation of free blacks. One of the stated goals was it would help end slavery as well. They would convince slave owners to let their slaves go and they would be shipped back to Africa. And the sad truth is that, you know, it started in 1816 and went right up through into the Civil War. And they only sent about 15,000 people over to what became the colony and then the nation of Liberia. which was not a large number when you consider that when the Civil War started, there were about 4 million enslaved Americans.
Well, and knowing all of this, and we've really distilled it quite a bit, but he had such interaction with African Americans. He freed some of his own slaves, and but didn't free others. And what does he say, looking at his writing, Star Spangled Banner, through that prism of slavery? What do you see him saying?
It's a complex issue because he had the deserved reputation in Washington of representing free blacks and slaves in the courts for free, at which he did his entire life. And that was controversial on the other side. And so he was known for that, and he was really was an ardent opponent of slave trafficking. Also, we might mention that he was an extremely pious individual. He almost went into the Episcopal priesthood.
Well, slavery comes up directly in the third verse of the song. It's a reference to his displeasure that the British encouraged escaped slaves to join their cause. During the War of 1812, Key writes, "No refuge," meaning with the British, "could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave." In other words, you know, you can join the British if you want, but that's not going to help you. But he also speaks of free men, and he's not meaning free black men. Let's listen. We heard a woman sing the Star Spangled Banner before a Memorial Day event, and she sings the fourth and final verse. Let's listen.
"Between their loved homes and the war's desolation, blessed with victory and pride, may our heaven rescued land praise the power that had made and preserved us a nation."
And again, through the eyes of someone today, it is a little jarring to hear someone speak of free men and know that there's a population that isn't free, but he lives in a different time.
That's correct. I mean, you can't judge this through the 21st century eyes. On the other hand, there are some universal feelings going on here. We know the line from the first verse, "the land of the free and the home of the brave." Mm. You know, how ironic is that when it didn't apply to a large segment of the population? So, yeah, I mean, the whole question of slavery, you can't get around it when you're dealing with the early republic.
Well, meanwhile, to the song that he writes, it was one of many popular American songs during Francis Scott Key's lifetime, during the Civil War, as you write. It became the unofficial national anthem of the North. Then it started to really grow. When did it become, you know, something that was heard at ceremonies and baseball games?
Right. Well, that didn't happen until the early 20th century. I mean, the momentum for the Star Spangled Banner to become the national anthem started growing in the last part of the 19th century. And it picked up in the early 20th century. The military, the Army, and the Navy used it as their official national anthem about that time. And it started being played at baseball games in the early part of the 20th century. And there were several bills in Congress throughout the years that were put in to make the Star Spangled Banner the national anthem. They didn't go anywhere until 1931, when the American Legion and the Veterans of Foreign Wars spearheaded a campaign to make that song national anthem. And they had hearings on Capitol Hill. They brought in a singer. And it, you know, the same arguments that you sometimes hear today, you know, difficult to sing. Don't ever start on a high note or you'll be sunk. You know, it's a song about war. Do we want a national anthem that's about war? It ends with a question. Do we want a song that ends with a question? It's anti-British. And, you know, by 1930, the British were one of our best friends. And there were other songs that were out there. America the Beautiful, for one, Battle Hymn of the Republic, that were in competition. But these hearings on Capitol Hill swayed the Congress, and Congress passed a resolution that President Hoover signed into law in 1931.
Well, and what are we to think of the man who wrote the song? He seemed good, but complicated, but maybe complicated in the way that Americans were in the time of slavery.
I would go along with that. Yeah, he was an honest, pious man who was a family man, who held strong principles. And yes, I would agree with that.
Mark Leifson, his new book is What So Proudly We Hailed, Francis Scott Key, A Life. We'll have an excerpt at hereandnow.org. And Mark, I wish you a happy 4th of July, and I just can't imagine the stories and the images that are swirling around in your head today.
Well, thank you very much, Robin. It was my pleasure to be on the show, and happy 4th.
And Mark reminds us that the first time the Star-Spangled Banner was ever played at a baseball game was during the 1918 World Series between the Chicago Cubs and the Boston Red Sox. Funny, the Cubs clobbered the Sox this week. This version we're listening to is Jose Feliciano during the 1968 World Series. It caused a firestorm because it was so different from the traditional versions. Listen for a second. Unbelievable that this was such a controversy, especially given how others sang it later. Roseanne Barr comes to mind. Controversy shadowed him for years, but today he says everyone has the right to sing it the way they want.